for this evening, RB from OB.
I'm Rob, I'm alcoholic. And glad to be here, glad to be sober. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we try not to have any kind of opinions on outside issues. But how about them Chargers? Where's Larry Lay at? Oh, excuse me. Yeah. No, I'm sure glad to be here and glad to be sober. And for those of you that introduce yourself to new as Alcoholics Anonymous, as you know, we have a lot of fun here, but you know what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with a malady that's fatal. You know, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. It's by far the best thing that ever happened to me. I want to again thank Larry for asking me to come and talk with you guys again. I had the privilege of coming and talking with this group a couple years ago, and I'm appreciative that you guys have asked me back. And I'd like to tell you that I've spruced up my story and added a couple car chases, maybe a couple bank robberies, and you know, something really, really exciting, but, you know, I just, you know, that's not my experience. I was just a pathetic drunk. I was kind of a pathetic drunk, and so my purpose here tonight is try to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Also, I want to thank all the people that make this meeting happen, and really, if you're new and you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous and it doesn't seem to be working for you, try working for AA. It really does make a big difference. And because the people that make this meeting happen are really, really important. You know, someone's got to get here and set up the chairs, and someone's got to make the coffee, and someone's got to, you know, there's just so much that goes along with making a meeting like this happen. And if you're new, I just hope that you can kind of join into this rotation of service and this commitment, you know, to giving, given back to what was so freely given to us. And I owe my whole life to Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that's good and decent in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. It's November 13th, 1987. And I'm 52 years old. So I've spent half my life as an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a long time. That's a lot of days. But really what it is, and I was just talking with a new man who's in his first few days of sobriety, and it's just about going, it's about getting 24 hours away from a drink each day. And what that means is it just means I put a few 24 hours together. So my experience is I've spent half my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I need to qualify with those of you that are new, because if you're probably sitting there going, you know, either he's not an alcoholic or he's lying. Hadn't had a drink in 26 years, over 26 years. But you need to understand that I drink alcohol, and I love the effect produced by alcohol. I love the effect produced by alcohol. And I'm not even sure that is what makes me alcoholic. My mother-in-law likes the effect produced by alcohol. In fact, she's 94 years old, and we just went out to dinner, and we were went for Mexican food, and she said, "Robbie, would you split a beer with me?" I said, "Pam, in my life I've never split a beer, and I'm not going to start tonight." So she likes the effect produced by alcohol. She gets a little better night's sleep with it. But see, she doesn't have that kind of symptom that I have, and that is that phenomenon of craving. As I share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now, I'm going to share with you a couple things that happened to me before I picked up a drink of alcohol. And I don't think any of that stuff made me alcoholic. I became alcoholic drinking alcohol. But there were some things that happened to me prior to drinking that influenced my life. I was adopted as an infant, come to later find out that I was probably predisposed to alcoholism. I found that out much, much later in life. So I grew up in a family where I felt a little bit odd, goofy, and different. You know, the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about feeling a little restless, irritable, and discontent. And I didn't know I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I just felt kind of odd, goofy, and different. You know, another thing that happened to me early before I picked up a drink of alcohol is that my father died when I was 9 years old. And up until that point, I went to Sunday school every Sunday. I was a good little boy. I tried to do what I was supposed to do. And, you know, when my father died, I got really, really mad at God because he let me down. And I knew I couldn't depend on him, and I knew I couldn't depend upon people. And I don't know, as a 9-year-old, if you can make a decision to be completely self-sufficient and not depend upon anyone or anything, but I think I just almost might have. You know, and I don't know that growing up, my father was alcoholic. You know, and I do know that my father liked the effect. He didn't have an opportunity to diagnose himself. He died actually younger than I am today. But I do remember as a young boy that he used to go out to the front seat of the Chevy Biscayne, and he'd always be just a little bit kind of depressed and grumpy. And I would watch him as a little boy go out to the front seat of the Chevy Biscayne and reach underneath and pull out a bottom of Seagram 7 out of a brown paper bag and take a couple pulls on it. He'd come in, and he felt a little bit better. I don't know if I took note. You know, that maybe there was something in there that might make me feel better. Those are just a couple things that happened to me before I took a drink of alcohol. That I don't know if it made me alcoholic or not. I had my first meaningful drink when I was about 13 years old. I was going to junior high dance. I'm 13 years old. I'm about 75 pounds, soaking wet. It's the 70s. I got long, stringy hair. I felt odd, goofy, and different. And me and my little buddy went down to Pat's Liquor down in Ocean Beach and got some bum to buy us 2 quarts of Old English 800. And, you know, I love malt liquor right from the get. What happened to me that night is I drank the malt liquor. I went in, I asked girls to dance. I had the time of my life. I woke up the next morning with my first hangover, not with the idea of, I don't want to do that anymore. It's like, how can I do that again? See, alcohol did something for me that I couldn't do for myself. Alcohol was my first solution. I've come to understand in Alcoholics Anonymous that alcohol was my first solution to alcoholism because I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, but the thing different than about me is that I from the very, very early stage of my drinking, I developed that phenomenon of craving. I identify with Sean. I appreciate Sean's talk, you know. When I got here, I didn't identify with Bill. You know, Bill had something and lost it. I got here, I'd never had anything. I started drinking at an early age. I drank every chance I could get. I tell you that first time I drank Old English, I wasn't going to drink Old English again. I went and bought, I went and got some Colt 45 the next time. You know, because essentially I liked the effect produced by alcohol. And, you know, by the time I was just a teenager, I was starting to get in trouble, you know, I drank every chance I could get, but growing up in Ocean Beach in the 70s, I used other things to treat my alcoholism. I mean, you know, you read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they use sedatives to taper off, too. I hear a lot of times people say in Alcoholics Anonymous refer to drugs as outside issues, and I refer to drugs as drugs. You know, an outside issue to me is having an opinion on the Charger game tomorrow. Because as a little kid, now what I'm getting at is, you know, I'm alcoholic. Don't get me wrong, I'm alcoholic. And it started with booze and it ended with booze. But I found a lot of other things to try to treat my alcoholism as a kid growing up in Ocean Beach in the 70s. Because in order to get booze when you're a kid, you got to go get someone to buy it for you. And if you're going down to some of those liquor stores, it's like, you know, it's like, can I get myself? I mean, I just got enough. I got a paper route and I mowed some lawns and I got enough money for two quarts of Old English 800. And a guy wants me to buy him a short dog. You know, so I found that I could get some other stuff that could change the way I feel. You know, and I use drugs to treat my alcoholism too. You know, and as a really young kid, and growing up in Ocean Beach in the 70s, if I want to get up, I can get up. If I want to get down, I can get down. If I need to get sideways, they got stuff for that too. You know, I huff toiling, I huff gas, I did all kinds of things to try to change the way I felt. You know, when my father died when I was 9 years old, we had gone back to Texas. I was born and raised here in San Diego, but I went back to Texas to take care of a sick grandmother. And then when my father died, we moved back to San Diego, and I moved next door to this family that had a bunch of boys, you know. And I was, you know, I didn't feel a part of my family, and I wanted to be a part of theirs, you know. But I was just this odd, goofy kid, and I just wanted acceptance. You know, the only thing that ever really kind of provided me acceptance was alcohol. God, it was a solution for me. But see, I have this kind of thing called progression, you know, and I have this thing like this phenomenon of craving. And by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I was just a mess. You know, I drank every chance I could get. I could not stop drinking once I started. You know, I tried to deal drugs. That didn't work. You know, I couldn't abide by that rule. Don't get high on your own supply rule. That never worked real well for me. So I always worked. And my first job I got when growing up is my uncle that raised me after my old man died was a hardworking man. His name was Dempsey. And Dempsey had this little equipment rental yard down on Midway Drive called Poor Boys Rentals. And that was my first job working down at Poor Boys. And he had all these really cool guys working for him. And I remember their names to this day. There was Indian George and Tennessee and Captain Zigzag and Wild Man Walt. And these guys were, I thought they were cool, you know. And they taught me things like how to drink in the morning to get over from drinking the night before. So I mean I worked in order to support, you know, protect and defend my right to drink and use anything else that I could. I never got fired from a job in my life. I always knew when the heat was on. I moved a lot. Yeah. By the time I was 17 years old, my mother had these. We had that talk and that sometimes moms have with boys that that are a little bit wayward, and that talk was, she told me that, she gave me those three loving words, and she says, "You get out." Get out. She says, "You cannot live your life the way you're living your life under my roof," so what I did is I went out for a while, and I came back with my tail between my legs, and I graduated from high school, and I started on a series of geographics. You know, that's what alcoholics do. You know, my first geographic, you know, because by this time I'm drinking, once I start drinking, I can't predict how much I'm going to drink. I do things tragic, incredibly tragic, insane things under the influence of alcohol. You know, I'm like the jaywalker. I'm like that guy that does tragic, incredibly tragic, insane things under the influence of alcohol. So I wear out my welcome, and I got to go. And my first geographic is I got out of high school, and I moved to Mammoth Lakes to become a ski bum. And I became half of that. there's a pattern here. Pay attention. And, you know, a couple years later, I came back with my tail between my legs, and I went back to work at Poor Boys Rentals. Because old Uncle Dempsey would always bail me out. He was like a father to me. And kind of stuck around for a while, and things kind of got worse, and my drinking kind of was causing some problems in my life. So I didn't make it as a ski bum, so I decided to move to Hawaii and become a surf bum. Accomplished half of that, too. There's a pattern here, you know. And that pattern is wherever I take me, there I am. And wherever I take me, it's like I've got this, by this time I've got this mind that can't live without alcohol. I got this obsession with alcohol. I don't even know what's wrong with me. But I cannot not drink alcohol. Even when I say, I'm not going to drink, I drink. Even when it's not a good idea to drink, I drink. You know, and I had to come here and find out what was wrong with me. I knew I was alcoholic before I got here. I just didn't know what that meant. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. You know, and after my first, I got done drinking in 1987. At the end of my drinking, and I just kind of fast forward a little bit. By this time, at the end of my drinking, I had gone through some of those progression, and I identify with chapter 3. I don't identify with all of chapter 3. I identify with trying various types of alcohol. You know, I went for many years, I was a tequila drinker, and I could go from being the life of the party to the wreck of the party, so I quit drinking tequila. I switched to rum. You know, and rum did terrible things to my insides. You know, and then I switched to vodka. And I always drink beer. God, you know, I didn't identify with Bill, but boy, I identified with Bob. He had an enormous capacity for beer. You know? God, and I had an enormous capacity for beer. You know, I tried all those kind of things in order to, you know, and not so much to control my drinking, but I tried those things not to get into so much trouble. You know, and at the end of my drinking, I was 26 years old. I'd become, well, let me back up just a little bit. At 26, I was just right before I became unemployed and unemployable. You know, I told you I never got fired from a job in my life, but in October of 1987, at this time I was very, very sick. I was drinking on a daily basis. I could not drink. I was getting very sick when I didn't drink. I was starting to throw up blood on a fairly regular basis. I was 26 years old, and I was dying from alcoholism, and I didn't know it. And one morning I woke up in October of 1987, and I called my boss, and I told him the truth. I didn't have any more excuses. And I called up my boss, and at this time I found a wonderful job for an alcoholic. I was working for Hornblower Party Yachts. Basically what I did is I just hung out on the docks and worked on boats. And I called my boss, and I told him the truth. I said, I don't have, you know, I couldn't come up with another excuse. I knew my time was up, and I couldn't remember if I'd had two grandmothers die. You know, I don't know if you ever told a lie to cover up a lie to cover up a lie to cover up a lie, and you just kind of, and you can't remember what stories you've told, you know? And my mama didn't raise a liar. But I just couldn't remember what stories I'd told. And so I told him the truth. He said, and I remember calling up. I said, John, it's RB. He said, what's it this time? I says, I've been drinking and doing cocaine for 3 days, and I'm not going to stop. He says, are you going to be in it all this week? And I said, John, I'm a liability. And I hung up that phone wondering, what the heck did I just do? Because the gig was up. I'd like to tell you I got sober. But I had another month of drinking. I went looking for help, and I couldn't find any. And in that last month of my drinking, things happened to me that I didn't think were humanly possible to happen to me. At this point, I was drinking around the clock. I could not stop drinking. And really, really kind of crazy, tragic things happened to me. It culminated in November of 1987. I was beat into a state of reasonableness by alcoholism with an assist from the Narcotics Task Force. And in handcuffs, I said, God, I can't live like this anymore. God, I can't live like this anymore. And I haven't lived like that since. And I'd like to tell you that was my last drink. And alcohol had quit working for me. But when I got out of handcuffs, I was shaken so violently that I went to, I wasn't the guy they were looking for. In fact, they asked me, they said, you're not supposed to say your last name here, but they said, Mr. B, you have 7 outstanding warrants for your arrest. By all right, we ought to take you to jail. And I said, go ahead, take me. And they said, we don't want you. Because I wasn't like a big shot or anything. I was just a hanger-on. I just happened to be in a place where something went down, and I tried to escape. So if you're out there and you get in an incident with those guys with the yellow jackets and the billy club, nightsticks, flashlights, hit the deck. That's my advice. Just hit the deck. Don't try to run. Because when I tell you I was beat into a state of reasonableness, I mean literally. So when I got out of handcuffs, I went and got myself a half pint of vodka and I drank it. I just drank it. And I'd like to tell you that was my last drink. And alcohol quit working for me, but I woke up the next morning and I was still shaking really, really bad. And I went down to Sea Trader Liquor down in Point Loma Avenue and I went in and I ordered 2 tall beers and I drank them because I needed a drink. At that time, I wasn't drinking for any reason other than I was drinking because I'd been drinking and I needed a drink. And if I had any idea that that was my last drink, I'd have ordered a 6-pack. Maybe one of those little cocktails in a can. But what happened to me when I was in, I think something happened from that moment that I was in handcuffs where I just said, God, I can't live like this. I said something was working in my life, despite me. And I made a call after I had those 2 tall beers. I called a friend of the family. His name was Big Ed. Big Ed's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's someone that I've known since I was a kid. And he'd been kind of concerned about me. A lot of people were concerned about me. And he said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. I'll be by tonight. And I remember when he came to take me to that first meeting, I said, where are we going? He says, we're going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I says, are you sure that it's anonymous? I'm a well-known drunk, but I don't want to be associated with you guys. Because I told you I wasn't looking good, and I remember walking into that first meeting at Tuesday night down at the old CARP program down at Sharp Cabrillo Hospital, and I walk into that meeting, and I still had I still had some crusty blood around my ear and a bruise on my face, and I just wasn't looking real good, and I didn't want to see anybody I knew. And sure enough, I walk into that meeting, and there was 3 people that knew me that said, hey, Robbie, we've been waiting to see you. We've been saving your seat. So they were a lot happier. I tell you what, I'm sure happy to see you guys tonight, but I sure wasn't happy that night. And I remember the meeting was weird. If you're new, real new, first time, this is weird. I know it's weird for you. It's got to be weird for you. It was weird for me. I walk into that meeting. I smoked a little bit of weed before I went because it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And Now, that was a Tuesday. My sobriety date's Friday because that was it. I mean, I smoked a little weed before I went to the meeting, and it was weird. They were saying hi, Bob, and hi, Bill, and hugging, and all this back slapping and reading. And then that birthday thing really threw me off. You know, there was a grown man celebrating 6 years. Weird. And there was this one guy that I knew there. His name was Jim W. And Jim W., I had known Jim for a long time. And I knew that he worked down on the docks. And I knew that he had a marine electronics business. And I thought maybe he could help me out. And after the meeting, you know, I said, "Hey, Jim, man, it's not going good, man. I got outstanding warrants for my arrest. I lost my job. She left. She left the cat. Cat had kittens in the closet. I'm being evicted. I got a 68 Ford pickup with one headlight and one window that I got a hot wire to get around in. I'm telling him all this, my problems, right?" And he says, "Come on out to my truck." And he opens up the utility bed of his truck, and he pulled up this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Robbie, if you can learn how not to drink a day at a time, all your problems will solve themselves." And I thought, what a chump. Because at that point, really what I need is I need a job, a girlfriend, place to stay, and it'd be nice to have better transportation. I mean, I'm 26 years old. I don't need much, but that's what I think I need. And this guy gives me a book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I couldn't even read the book. It didn't even make sense to me. So what happened was the next day I accepted a voluntary commitment to an institution. You know? Because I came to you guys and I didn't think it would work. And it's crazy that they loaded me up in a van and took me back to you guys. I said, "Where are we going?" They said, "AA." I said, "I've been there, not impressed." And they said, "Fine, don't go." And I said, "Well, where are you going?" They said, "They're going to AA." I said, "What time does the bus leave?" You know, and in that institution where I dried out, you know, they pointed out something to me that I had neglected to see, and that was I didn't have anywhere to go. You know, I didn't have anywhere to go. So at 26 years old, the best thing that I could do after being dried out was I accepted a voluntary commitment to a long-term institution for homeless alcoholic men. And I ended up at Pathfinders on 30th and Cedar. And I didn't have anywhere else to go. And you know, when I was young back then, there wasn't a lot of young people at Pathfinders at that time. And you know, and there were old guys that say, "I spilt more than you drank." I had a standard response for those guys. I said, "If you'd have done more swilling and less spilling, you could have got here looking better." Yeah. And I remember, you know, because when you get to an institution like that, they put you on restriction. And my first restriction, this is important. You know, someone asked me to tell this story because it's important to me. I don't know. Because sometimes, you know, I believe that a God that I don't always understand will sometimes put people in your life, you know, just at the right time. Just at the right time. So I'm on a 3-day restriction at this place, Pathfinders, and this old man came up to me, and his name was William. And he walked up to me, and he said, "Are you the new guy in the house?" I said, "What?" He said, "Are you the new guy?" He had no teeth. I said, "Yeah, I'm the new guy." He says, "Want to go to the door?" And I'm thinking, "What? You want to go to the store?" I didn't have anything better to do, so I'm walking around Golden Hills with this old stumble bum. I'm a beach drunk. I got standards here, right? Now, if there's any real beach drunks here, you know the difference between sand fleas and coke bugs. Sand fleas are really there. You can't see them, but they're there. If you slept on the beach, you know what I mean. But I'm walking around. Did I digress? I better come back. So I'm walking around Golden Hills with this guy named William, and I remember he said, "You want to go to the store?" And we went to the store, and we were walking through this little market in Golden Hills, and he took me down the aisle where there was the spices, and he pointed out the lemon extract. He said, "You see that?" I says, "What?" He says, "Lemon extract." I says, "What about it?" He said, "Got more alcohol than vanilla." And he says, "And it'll go down pretty good. We'll bubble up." You know that man? Here's the thing about that man. That man had steel, cold, blue eyes. And when I looked in his eyes, I saw myself. I saw myself. And he said, "Yeah, when you get to be where I've been after you live on the streets for enough years," he says, "they won't... He says, they'll bird dog you when you get near the alcohol," but he says, "but they won't bother you in the spice aisle." And I was more afraid of going where he was and had been than he was of going back, because 2 days later he was gone. But I saw my future as a practicing alcoholic in his eyes. You know, and in that institution, I was introduced to the book Alcoholics Anonymous as a text, as a basic text. And in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I began to identify. You know, I didn't originally identify, but the first thing I identified was, you know, when someone, you know, I was reading a book, like a textbook. It wasn't making much sense. I don't identify with Bill. He had stuff, lost stuff. I never had anything. You know, he drank in speakeasies. What's that? You know, it's like he drank bathtub gin. It's like, I never drank in the tub. Come on. You know, I needed a sponsor to help me understand that stuff, that it was a different language in a different time, and I didn't quite relate. But when I did get a sponsor, and sponsor said, "Let's go read the doctor's opinion." And that's where I first identified, when I said, "Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol." I said, "Yes, that's why I drink." And then it talks about different type of alcoholics. And it talked about that one distinction. And that's that phenomenon of craving. And that's where I identified. You know, and then when we started reading that other stuff, I identified. Step one, you know, I was in a book study with this ex. This guy was kind of weird. He was like an ex-Marine, but he was also this like stumble bum from the from beach drunk from wind and sea. So, I mean, he was kind of a... But I kind of liked him, you know, because he smoked Cools. And I like menthols. I haven't had a cigarette in over 20 years. But he kind of helped me understand step one in a manner that I never really understood step one. And we were doing a little big book study, and he asked me if, and he had all of us in this institution that were living there. He said, "How many of you choose not to drink today?" "I choose not to drink today." And he said, "Then why are you here? Why are you here?" You know? And I kind of, it helped me understand that somewhere along the line, I lost the power of choice and drink. I drink against my say-so. I'll say, "So, I'm not going to drink today," and I drink. I lost the say-so and drink. You know, and it helped me identify with step one. In and of myself, I cannot not drink. Today, as it was the day before, I need a power greater than myself. And that first power was the group. That was the first power for me. And those grumpy old dudes in AA. They told me things like, you know, there's only two things you need to know about God. There is one and it ain't you. That's what those guys, that's what they told me. And I was kind of a little bit of a smart butt, so I said, "Well, I'll use the ocean as my higher power. I can taste it, I can touch it. When I'm in it, I feel like I'm living in the moment. It provides my life meaning and purpose. I'm a surfer, I'm a waterman," all this crap. Just waiting for them to throw me out of AA. And you know what they said? They said, "We're glad you found a pirate power kit. Keep coming back." And really, I mean, it was that simple with the first three steps. You know, I started reading the book and I identified. You know, but they were also kind of really big back then we were talking earlier about, you know, like what step are you on, who's your sponsor, what meetings you going to. You know, they'd drill you when you walked in if you were new. They'd bird dog you, they'd follow you around, if you're new, yeah. And one time that same old timer, he said, what step you on? I said, I did the third step. You know, I'd read in the book. Armed with a little bit of information, I could be dangerous. He said, really? How'd you do that? Take that third step. I said, out of the big book. Said the prayer. And he showed me the paragraph after the third step prayer, where it says, next, we launched on a course of vigorous action, first step, personal house cleaning. So thank goodness that that man told me what God's will for me was, and that was to continue with the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me, and then he got real kind of like this, you know, I don't like it when people point their finger at me, but he says, I've been watching you, and an alcoholic like you, you're a lot like me. He says, you know, when you produce a piece of paper where you've written a personal inventory, then and only then will you have fulfilled the requirement for willingness that's asked for in the third step. Yeah. And I'm glad I had those kind of lessons. You know? And I got more afraid. And in every meeting I went to, people said I didn't do a four step and I got drunk. And I was terrified I was going to get drunk. And I don't want to get drunk. You know, so that kind of got me through that initial fourth and fifth step. And six and seven was, thank you. The six and seven, I got 10 minutes. Six and seven was kind of, the first time through, was kind of easy. What those of you, if you that have been around a little bit, there's a lot more work that goes with six and seven. But the first time through, it was, you know, the hard thing for me was being quiet for an hour. And returning home. I'm homeless. Just, you go be quiet for an hour when you return home. It's like, you know, and for me to be quiet for an hour when I was newly sober, I think I smoked 5 Marlboros and 2 Cools, you know, and then I had this brilliant idea that I heard in a meeting. I heard someone say they burned their inventory and watched all their resentments go up in flames and smoke and. So I remember sitting there trying to be quiet for an hour. I torched my inventory, you know. A little bit later, my sponsor came to me and he says, how are you working on it? How are you doing on that ninth step? I says, well, I haven't made the list yet. He says, where's your inventory? I says, I burned it. He said, whose idea was that? I said, oh. So that's why it's important if you're new to get a sponsor, because sometimes you hear things in meetings that aren't always that helpful, you know. I mean, you know, but returning home was because I didn't have a home. You know, but that initially kind of helped me get through the steps. You know, I was in the first year. I want to thank my lovely wife and my friend Toby for kind of joining us. And there's a few other people here, Chris and Tiffany and Dude that's kind of came along. I met Gail when I was living at Pathfinders, and. You know, Gail's the eternal optimist. I mean, I'm living at Pathfinders, and she's like, I don't know why she get involved. I mean, you know, she saw something. I don't know what she saw. She's kind of like that kid that's playing in the horse manure thinking there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. But I met Gail when I was in my first year of recovery, and we both stayed sober, you know, which is really kind of an amazing feat. You know, it isn't anything about Gail, or it's really nothing about me. It's about Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded us this amazing life. But I met her in my first year, and when you're new and you're getting involved with another new person, that's not 13th stepping. That's 1st and 12th. That's when your life's unmanageable and you find someone else to share it with. You Actually, I was kind of trying to be smart about it. I thought, I have 9 months and she has 3 months. And they said, wait a year. And I did the math. I thought accumulative, that's pretty close. But what it really was is I had that, what I've come to understand is I had that spiritual void, that malady. See, I got this threefold condition called alcoholism. I got a mind that can't live without a drink. And I got a body that can't handle alcohol because I put alcohol in my system and I trigger that phenomenon of craving. But when I don't have alcohol, I feel ill at ease. And I've come to understand that as that spiritual malady of alcoholism. And when I didn't have alcohol, I thought maybe she could fix me. And she couldn't fix me. What happened is we had a hot and heavy relationship for about 6-9 months and it just got crazy and we had to go our separate ways. And we got busy working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor, taking the steps. And a couple years later, we ran into each other at a conference, and I asked her to dance. We've been dancing ever since. And I've been married over 20 years. I'm not capable of that. To the most amazing woman in the world. I mean, that's a long-term relationship, 20 years. I mean, when I was drinking, a long-term relationship was like the weekend. I don't know what it is about bedwetters, but it seems to turn women off. I haven't wet the bed since I got sober. There may be a correlation here. You know, we've had this amazing life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I've gone through way more pain sober than I ever did drinking. You know, I could just numb out with alcohol and drugs for years and years and years I did, and congratulations on the cakes, and you know, one of the most, I've outlived two sponsors in this program. I've had wonderful sponsorship. My first sponsor was a man by the name of Ron Wynn, and he was just a champion for Alcoholics Anonymous and a good member and a man that I've tried to model my life after, and I've just never quite made the mark. And on Ron's deathbed, when he was dying from cancer, he was kind of going in and out of consciousness. We were bringing meetings to him. I was about 6 years sober, and he kind of all of a sudden he came to, and his eyes kind of pierced me, and he said, Robbie, I wish you lots of pain. And I thought, oh, man. See, Ron was real big about pain as a touchstone to all spiritual growth. And if you can walk through life's painful experiences sober, you'll grow closer to a God of your own understanding. And so he taught me how to live through his death. You know, and he taught me how to take care of those about me. You know, my mother passed away. When, you know, Gail's sponsor, Corinne Cheney, died with 50 years of sobriety. And we walked through all that kind of stuff, you know. I've had people that I've sponsored die. So, you know, I mean, there's tough times ahead. But anybody can turn to a chicken shit solution you find in a bottle or a bag to relieve your pain. You know, and living sober is about walking through life's painful experiences with dignity. You know, when Ron passed away, I needed to get another sponsor. So I went to his best friend and a friend of mine, Peter Fleischman. And Peter was my sponsor until he passed away. And now I got this good old-timer by the name of Griff that goes to my home group. And I've known him throughout my whole sobriety. You know, I've had good sponsorship. You know, but I've walked through some stuff sober. Because that's life. You know. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that amends. I want to be thinking of that. My mother raised me. She was a good woman. One of the toughest amends that I had to make, I want to talk a little bit about the steps. Because it is, I mean, the toughest amends I had to make was, some of them was just paying back money. Paying back money is easy. You just got to work. And it may take a while, but you can pay back money. But one of the toughest amends I had to go to was my mother, and I had to admit to my mother when I was drinking I was selfish. I mean, not I'm sorry. You know, one of my sponsorship I've had is we got to look at the exact nature of your wrongs. You got to look where you were at fault. You got to make direct amends. 2 minutes left. And I had to go to my mother and tell my mother when I was drinking, I was selfish, I was dishonest, I was inconsiderate, I borrowed money, I didn't pay it back, I lied to you, I caused you sleepless nights, and all that was wrong. In order for me to stay sober, I got to make that right. You know, at the time I thought she let me off the hook because she said, son, if you really want to make that right, you need to keep doing what you're doing. If I quit doing Alcoholics Anonymous, I might as well go pee on her grave. Because I made a decision very early to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And what I told her I was willing to do is I was willing to go to any lengths to right my wrongs. Any lengths. You know, sometimes this thing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, continuing to suit up and show up and go to meetings and be of service and take commitments, you know, I it's like, well, for how long? You know? Well, a day at a time. I'm going to share something with you out of the big book. It's not my story. It's a woman's story in the big book. One of my favorite stories in the big book. But it kind of it describes to me my life in Alcoholics Anonymous in a better than I could. She said she wrote it so much better than I could ever express it. So I'm just going to change one word here as far as the amount of time. I'm going to kind of it's from the story Keys to the Kingdom, and the last few paragraphs says, so I'm going to change one word. The last 26 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments because that is life. But I also have a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. To these people I am truly related. First, through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. As the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now, there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys to the kingdom. You know, I think that's so beautiful. I love the gift. I look at my sobriety as an amazing, amazing gift. You know, what I have today, I don't deserve it. I didn't earn it. I can't pay for it. It's priceless. You know, if I think about it, and, you know, I mean, I hear people say, I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't earn my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was welcome here when I wasn't welcome at the Catalina Lounge or the Arizona Club. And all you guys said was, keep coming back. So, thank God I didn't get what I deserved. And I can't pay for this thing because it's absolutely priceless. So if I didn't deserve it and I didn't earn it and I can't pay for it, how do I keep it? You know, it says old Dr. Bob, his message was just keep passing it on. Anyway, you guys, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. It's by far the best thing that ever happened to a guy like me. Thanks.